So this is Jack two. Talking about the Hal and Tal.
Yeah. So Cornwall is there are two things about living up and growing in Cornwall, which is about permissions and who has the right to do something, and it's really, really, really very, very, very strong. So for a very long time, I never visited Padstow because I'm from Helston and I love Helston Floridae and I am annoyed by the people that come and visit it. I like people who could bring family in. I like people who bring their friends in. But, you know, you can have 20,000 people just on the main street, loads of tourists. And so I always felt like until I got invited to Padstow, I was never going to go. My friend Jenny lives in Padstow and I told her once, I'm never going to go to Padstow, you know, I'm never going to do it. Until someone invites me, someone lives in Padstow, like invites me. She goes, "That's really good." And I said, "Yeah, I'm never going to go until someone invites me." She goes, "Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. That's really great, and Jenny. I'm never going to go to Padstow until someone invites me." Oh, do you want to come to Padstow? Yes, thank you. And that was when I was in my late 30s, 40s. I was in my 40s by that point. Anyway, but it's about permissions. I didn't think that I had the right to go to Padstow. Lots of people think that they did. I, for whatever reason, didn't think I did. Same thing about Helston. Lots of people think that there are rights involved, and these myths are really strong and quite important, because if you want to keep something nuanced, if you want people perceive it as an inside and an outside, and that's quite important, because in actual fact there is no inside and outside, and you can get in, and if you want to be in, there's all sorts of, it's all very porous. Anyway, I grew up at school doing the dancing, so I led the dance once.
Because you're from Helston.
Because I'm from Helston.
Yeah.
And I, but at school I danced, and there was another faction that did the Hal and Tal, and they were much more naughty and more chaotic. And but that wasn't me. I danced. They did the Hal and Tal, and I felt when I was growing up that eventually I was a dancer, and they were doing the Hal and Tal, and that's where I was. When I came back down to Cornwall, my friend Milo had, by sheer dint of having a kilt, was invited to be in the Hal and Tal to carry the flag. There was a guy called Ronnie who was amazing, who did it for decades. Ronnie carried the flag. He had a flag and a kilt, and he would turn up and do the Hal and Tal. And I don't think anyone ever asked him. He just did it. And when he got too old to do it anymore, they found Milo, and Milo was invited in. But I never felt that I had agency to join, to be part of it.
Wow.
I wasn't part of it, and I didn't feel that I was allowed. And at that point, I moved back down to Cornwall, and despite being from Helston, I was living in Redruth. Anyway, I had no agency, I had no permission to be part of it. Milo couldn't do it 1 year, and so he invited me to take over. And that meant, because I had a kilt. And so I took the kilt, put it on, went down, and I carried the flag for Hal and Tal in Florida, and it was utterly amazing. I had an amazing day, and when Milo came the next year and said, "Can I have the flag back?" I told him to bugger off. I had the flag; he had given me permission, and I was in. And anyway, I thought I was doing it better than him. he disagreed, but I had the flag, and he couldn't get it back off me. So what he became is an ogier. He started sort of like, you know, making lots of shouty noise in the Hal and Tal. Now I'm the crier for the Hal and Tal. And the way that happened is Howard Curnow had been doing it for years and years and years. So the flag carrier is the assistant to the crier. And what it is that Howard, he, at the end of the Hal and Tal many years ago, he walked off home with the costume and refused to give it back. And that's how he became the year by year, because you have to hand the costumes back right at the end of each day, at the end of Hal and Tal. But the traditional for the crier, not the town crier, but the crier for Hal and Tal, the crier is, at the end of it, you walk home with the costume. So in exactly the same way that I walked home with the flag and never gave it back, I walked home with the costume and never gave it back. And I've been the crier ever since, because I've got the costume in the cupboard. And it's very odd. People, because I'm a crier, people think that I've got some kind of agency, that I've got some kind of influence, and people ask me, you know, about the Hallentau. And the truth of the matter is, you know, just like the, you know, like many things, it's a sort of, it's smoke and mirrors, you know. People think there are these massive, great big traditions around things, but actually it's just some, around some petty theft. And, but you know, if you stand up in front of 20,000 people and ring a bell and get everyone to shut up and listen to you, people think you have some kind of power. And of course, you don't really. You're just playing a part, you know. Yeah. You're just, it's an ancient tradition, you know, that goes back like to 1978 probably. But certainly there's you know, providence of sort of like somebody starting it off, like that goes back hundreds of years, maybe, who knows. So the degree to which sort of like I have agency or I have the power. And that's a really interesting thing about Cornwall, is that people think they then have to ask my permission for things.
Yeah, yes. That's good, though. That's really great, isn't it? Because it's kind of, yeah, you end up somewhere that you perhaps wanted to be but didn't expect to be. And then at some point someone else will probably walk home in the costume. And
well, the thing about giving the costume back is Howard Curnow, when I got the costume off Howard Curnow, I had an email saying, come round to the house, I need to talk to you about something. And I went down to his house and knocked on the door. And his wife knocked, opened the door and said, ah, you're here to see Howard. He's upstairs in the bedroom. You better go up. And it's like, oh, my God. And there's many things rush through your head when you turn up to a house you've never been to before.
Yeah.
With no, and someone says, please go upstairs to the bedroom. And you sort of think, one way or another, it's not going to be good, is it? And I went upstairs and Howard was lying in the bed. And he was wearing, I remember he was wearing a string bed, and he just looked awful. His cheeks were sunken. His clay, you know, just like grey, and you know, and his, I remember his hands being really bony, he'd lost so much weight, and he was lying in bed, and next to him on the bed laid out on the bed next to him was the crier's outfit, and he sort of like reached over and he patted it and he said, I want you to have it, boy, I want you to have it. The implication being, he didn't want to give it back. He didn't want it to go back into Hallentau. He wanted in some way to influence what happened next and sort of give it to somebody. And, I mean, he just looked dreadful. He just looked awful. And he had lymphoma. And we knew he'd been ill because for the previous year, he'd done the whole Hallentau on an electric wheelchair. And he couldn't make one or two of them. And out of the blue, he just said, you do the next one because I'm not going to be able to. And it was like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm going to say. So we've been filling in for him for a little bit, in a tiny, very small way. And he'd been doing it for decades, you know, he'd been doing it since the 70s. Anyway, the following year, you know, so of course I've got the outfit, and I said, and they would do the first one, and he'd say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, just for a moment, you know, we're all here gathered, but let's remember there's some people missing. So it's obvious Howard's not here. And there's this sort of hush, because everybody, you know, poor Howard. And I said, he's all right. There's nothing wrong with him. He's in Australia on holiday, because he had a recovery from his lymphoma and was actually quite breezy by that point. And he'd sort of like, it had taken loads out of him. But in the following year, he'd got a bit better, and he'd gone off to Australia. He decided that he couldn't be on Helston for Florida, and he'd gone off to Australia instead for a few days. And then he was around for a couple of years afterwards, and it was really sweet. You get to give him a hug in the street. But he passed away, a couple of years ago. But it's odd, Howard was the Hallentau, the face of, the voice of. He's the person that I grew up listening to speaking Cornish. So the first Cornish I ever heard was Howard doing it. It's the, you know, way back in the 70s. The first Cornish flag I ever saw was in the Hallentau. So yeah, it's also kind of like emotive stuff. So to be given the very first flag that I was, as far as I'm concerned, that is the Cornish
same flag. Yeah.
It is what it is. It's Ronnie's flag.
Yeah.
Ronnie's flag is still used today. It's the flag I saw when I was tiny, when I was, you know, back in the 70s. And the words that I speak are Howard's words, and those are the words that I heard back in the 1970s as well. So yeah, it's all come to hand.
Thank you. That's very, very lovely. So I'll just ask you to introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Jack. I'm Jack Morrison. Hello.
Hello. And a resident of Redruth.
I'm a resident of Redruth, yes.
So Fire away.
Okay. So when my children were very little, I used to take them in the prams and push. I put them in the pram and push them round. So it was, Max was very little. So I worked part time for a long time and got very, very au fait with all of the streets and back streets of Redruth, because I used it as an excuse to go and explore. And the building that we're sitting in now is Crescent Kona, and then it was the brewery site, which had been claimed to have been burned down by the Cornwall National Liberation Army. Lots to be said about that. Anyway, it stood here empty for a very long time with no roof, and you know, and there was a, it was fenced off, but I knew where the kids got in because I walked past it with the pram. Anyway, a couple of years later, I was working up at Restormel Castle, and we needed a marquee. We had a marquee, and we weren't allowed to pierce the ground. We weren't allowed to put stakes into the ground, so we were weighing it down with water barrels. So there was a need to move water barrels around. And I knew through looking through the fence there was an old broken barrel trolley specifically designed for shifting barrels in this site. You could see it sort of off in the distance in the ruined building. So early one morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I was supposed to be up at Restormel by 8.
And this is for Knee-High?
This is for Knee-High Theatre, yes. So Knee-High Theatre is for Cymbeline. And I'd be there for 8 in the morning to sort of tidy up, because everyone was going to be get there at 9. So you get there nice and early and sort of like make sure everything's shipshape. And one of the things I wanted to do was shift the barrels around so that when people came in, they could see that something had happened. But shifting, like, because they weigh like quarter of, you know, the two, you know, this is a barrel of water. It weighs a quarter of a ton. Do you know what I mean? So anyway, I knew where the trolley was. So got up early in the morning, came down. It was a beautiful sunny morning. And I slipped through the fence, parked around the corner in Tesco's, walked up, slipped through the fence, walked in, walked straight across through this building, through the rooms that we're in at the moment, picked up the trolley and started to walk it back. And it was one of the wheels was a bit knackered. But it worked, you know, it was like, it was going to do the job. Started to walk it back, and then suddenly I could hear a noise. I could hear people talking, I heard people coming. And there were signs everywhere saying that security were here, but it was casual. They weren't. They just weren't. They were never here. But now I could hear noises, and I could hear people coming, and I'm making quite a lot of noise with my trolley, and I thought, oh, God, right. And I've got to get past back to the fence. Anyway, I come around the corner, and through one of the big doorways comes another couple of people, a man and a woman, with a shopping trolley that they'd got from Tesco's, full of all the copper pipe work from this building. And instead of it being security guard, and they looked at me and I looked at them and they went, morning, and I said, oh, morning, right? And so I went my way with my trolley and they went their way with their trolley.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely moment in Redruth history where people were just sort of like coming in here and slowly excavating out all the burned out sort of like rubbish and nonsense and recycling it places.
Very nice, thank you. I'm going to ask you something else. So this is Jack, story 3.
Well, it's not really a story, but it's one that you and I both share, and with myself and the interviewer, Becca, which is about being in Cornwall and living in poverty. Through a complicated, not a very simple series of events, in 2009, I found myself living in poverty with two toddlers. You know, poverty is a really funny thing. It's a very sort of like blanket term. And, you know, there's a whole thing about, you know, the degree to which you're on benefits. So I was below the poverty line for a few years and then got a pay rise of £250, which put me £200 above the poverty line, which meant that I didn't get any benefits. Well, sorry, my benefits were reduced. So oddly, my experience of having an extreme lack of money was extended by the fact that I got a very small pay rise, which took me above this thing. But it's a thing, you know, you and I both know what that's like. You know, if your wages go up just a tiny little bit, you have to watch out because it has a knock-on effect. So, and it's part of growing up here, part of my kids growing up here in Redruth, is that for a long time, you know, at school, certainly up until they got, until Max was in secondary school, money was really tight, you know, and so shopping bills of above £45 were could be problematic. So you know, you'd have a target for the first 3 weeks of the month, And if I hit those targets, then at the end of the month, I could spend £60 and buy the luxury items. And if I missed those targets, then I couldn't. And that's not unusual here. In actual fact, many of my peers at the school gate, that was quite luxurious. That was quite, you know, they were on £35 as opposed to £45. I was doing okay. I had my £35 weeks, but by and large, you know, I was doing okay. And there's this perception, I was doing a national project recently where people had come from all over the country, and we went for a drink afterwards, and some of the guys from Yorkshire and Lancashire started talking about Northerners and Southerners, and how soft Southerners are and how luxurious they have it. And it kind of struck, it's really upset me. It's really sort of like gone through me. It is really profoundly upset me, because the people in this town are in the bottom 10% by indices of deprivation. Anywhere in Europe, let alone fucking Britain, and for people to judge because we've got palm trees in the streets that everything must be okay, or that in some way life is. Because we've got beaches, life is soft, right? You know, you and I both know. I mean, you've got Battery Rocks nearby.
Yeah.
But that's Battery Rocks. And the reason you can swim off Battery Rocks is because no tourists want to.
And it's free.
And it's free. It costs me to go to the beach.
Yeah.
It costs me to go to the beach. It costs me to use any of this stuff in Cornwall. And it's a bit of a trope. You know, we've been talking about it for many years. But there's still a truth about all of this, which is we live somewhere absolutely brilliant and the community is really strong and it's great here. Mm. But, now I've been promoted and I've got a job and I don't have to worry about food as in the same way. You know, I have to worry about other things, but food is something, I'm no longer in food poverty and it's extraordinary. But I think it's really, really important to keep going back to it and realise that it's very easy to get mixed up in the jam and cream debate.
Yes, I completely agree.
And the jam and cream debate is a ploy by society to make us talk about the little things and not talk about the big things.
Yeah.
And the thing about all of the stuff in Cornwall is there are some really, really, really big things going on, you know. You tell funny stories about people, stripping out salvage from burned out buildings, but they're not doing it for fun. They're not getting up first in the morning for a laugh. They're getting up in the morning and scrapping things because they've got no money and they can get money from the scrapyard for things that are just lying around. So I wanted to talk about it because I'm aware I'm leaving that world behind to a degree.
Oh, wow.
But it's
still there.
But it's still there, and I could go back at any second. You know, I wasn't in it, and then I really was in it for years, and my kids were growing up that way. And the thing is, it's so precarious. You know, I'll be back in it at a heartbeat.
This isn't the end of Jack's story, but it's interesting that perception of the North South, and I think it's perpetuated anyway, isn't it, through the news, and that we're kind of lumped Southwest Cornwall is lumped in with the southeast and the very rich areas, and it doesn't mean there's not poverty there. There's Jasper, okay. But for me as well, like the story hasn't changed because obviously being brought up in Carnbrae, Redruth, our story as kids was mum being incredibly ingenious and finding all sorts of ways of providing food. And there's, I mean, I won't go on the back of this one, but you know, there's a story in our family which is kind of when mum had run out of cat food, because we did have a cat, so gave the cat an egg and then cried because she had one egg to split between me and my sister, and everything was rationed. And it's like, that's kind of, yeah, it's an interesting, things don't change and it's unseen. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, with especially it's unseen.
And we people concentrate on the stories like the South is really soft or jam should go on first. And all that stuff is just bullshit. what it is there's poverty in Britain.
Yeah.
There's poverty in Britain in post-industrial places, and this is a post-industrial place, and we have to live with that.
Yeah.
And you're right, you know, the southeast, anyway.
The north-south divide. There should be a north-south and then south-west divide. Oh, thanks.